Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, let's begin right up with the public health news and research roundup.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research Roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up from Inside Climate News, study links short-term air pollution exposure to hospitalizations for growing list of health problems. A new Harvard University study for the first time links hospitalizations for common blood, skin, and kidney ailments to short-term exposure to fine particulate matter from fossil fuel combustion and wildfires. The findings widen the population of older Americans considered especially vulnerable to threats from the air pollutant, even when exposed to it over short periods. Led by researchers at Harvard University School of Public Health, the study published in the British Medical Journal found that short-term exposure to fine particulate matter led to higher levels of hospitalizations for people with illnesses such as septicemia or blood poisoning, kidney failure, urinary tract infections, skin and other tissue infections, and electrolyte disorders often brought on by loss of fluids from vomiting or diarrhea. Researchers defined short-term as exposure on the day of hospitalization and compared the pollution levels to the day before. The population study was Americans over the age of 65 through a vast analysis of Medicare records for the 48 continental states. As the amount of particulate matter 2.5 or PM2.5 increased between the days analyzed, so did the hospital admissions rate connected to those disease groups. Further, the link between exposure to fine particulate matter and hospitalizations was still evident even when the daily air pollution levels were lower than current World Health Organization guidelines and even the less stringent U.S. regulatory standards. The researchers studied the microscopic pollutant known as PM2.5, which is generated by fossil fuel combustion in power plants and vehicles and by wildfires. The tiny particles infiltrate the lungs, contributing to heart disease and worsening respiratory conditions such as asthma over the long term, studies have shown. A 2015 study by the World Health Organization estimated that regular exposure to outdoor PM2.5 caused 3.7 million premature deaths worldwide each year. Previous studies showed the exposure to PM2.5 heightened the risk of hospitalization, largely for cardiovascular and respiratory illnesses, diabetes, and Parkinson's disease. The new study indicates that people with diseases other than those with a clear link to heart or lung problems are also harmed by even short-term exposure to particulate matter 2.5. The study shows that the health dangers and economic impacts of air pollution are significantly larger than previously understood, said Yangguan Wei, the study's lead author. Okay, next up, big news from AJMC.com. Americans drinking, drug use, despair, wiping out life expectancy gains. 3 straight years of declining life expectancy from 2014 to 2017 have roots that go back to the 1980s, when the authors say U.S. life expectancy began to lose pace with other countries. drinking, drug use, obesity, isolation, and related ills are rolling back a half century of gains in life expectancy in the United States. And these trends started so long ago they may be hard to reverse, according to a sobering analysis appearing today in the Journal of the American Medical Association. 3 straight years of declining life expectancy from 2014 to 2017 have roots that go back to the 1980s, when U.S. life expectancy began to lose pace with other countries, said Stephen Wolf, MD, and Heidi Shoemaker, both of the Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth School of Medicine. Using nearly 60 years of data from the U.S. Mortality Database and CDC from 1959 to 2017, Wolf and Shoemaker painted a grim picture of how certain causes of death have climbed among Americans at midlife, those between 25 and 64, before they become eligible for Medicare. Their findings amplify the data first highlighted by Princeton's Ann Case and Angus Deaton, who coined the terms, quote, deaths of despair, in reporting the uptick in deaths from opioid and alcohol abuse and suicide. The Journal of the American Medical Association report confirms the rise of those causes, especially since the 1990s, but adds to them deaths from obesity, hypertension, and renal failure, all related to poor nutrition and lack of exercise, that have been public health officials' radar for some time. And the report adds social isolation, identified by health plans as a leading cause of morbidity and mortality, as an additional culprit. An accompanying editorial cites a study that found it increased the risk of death by 29%. For decades, the authors say, this quilt of morbidity has created an undercurrent in the U.S. healthcare landscape. While official U.S. life expectancy continued to rise due to advances in other areas, such as better treatments for heart disease and cancer, and declining smoking rates, especially among those with better access to education and insurance. But Wolf and Shoemaker note that the triple wave of the opioid crisis, first oxycodone, OxyContin, then heroin, and now fentanyl, a slowdown in the health gains in other areas, and a rise in chronic stress and suicide, have finally exposed what they call the U.S. health disadvantage. Rising midlife mortality is strongly tied to income, and the analysis reveals both a strong rural-urban divide as well as shifting fortunes over time for some parts of the country. The authors note that in 1959, Kansas had the nation's highest life expectancy at 71.9 years, but in 2016, it ranked 29th. The authors, as well as commentators in an editorial, say the policy implications are significant and challenging. The editorial by authors from the Harvard School of Public Health note that the effects of obesity were predicted 15 years ago, but today, 80% of adults do not meet U.S. physical activity guidelines. Half of adults have hypertension, mostly uncontrolled. After years of progress on fighting tobacco, the rise of e-cigarettes presents a new health challenge. And rising despair and suicide rates, 85% of which are by a firearm or non-poisoning, point to the challenge of fully integrating mental health into the care landscape after decades of stigma and sectoring it out of the rest of most health plans. Medicare and Medicaid should lead the way, the editorial states. Okay, next up, this from Science Daily. Healthcare, mass shootings, 2020 election causing Americans significant stress. A year before the 2020 presidential election, Americans report various issues in the news as significant sources of stress, including healthcare, mass shootings, and the upcoming election, according to this year's Stress in America survey by the American Psychological Association. More than half of U.S. adults, 56%, identified the 2020 presidential election as a significant stressor, an increase from the 52% of adults who reported the presidential election as a significant source of stress when asked in the months leading to the 2016 contest. According to this year's survey, around 7 in 10 adults, 69%, say that healthcare is a significant source of stress, nearly equal to the 71% who say mass shootings are a significant source of stress. Among adults who experience stress about healthcare at least sometimes, 47%, the cost of healthcare is the most commonly cited source of that stress at 64%. Adults with private insurance, 71%, are more likely than those with public insurance, 53%, to say that the cost of healthcare causes them stress. More than half of adults overall, 55%, worry that they are not able to pay for healthcare services that they may need in the future. Mass shootings are the most common source of stress cited by U.S. adults in 2019, with more than 7 in 10 adults saying mass shootings are a significant source of stress in their lives. This is an increase from 2018, when 62% said mass shootings were a significant source of stress. By demographic, Hispanic adults are most likely to say mass shootings are a significant source of stress, with 84%, followed by blacks at 79%. Stress related to climate change and global warming has increased significantly since last year, 56% in 2019 versus 51% in 2018. And more adults are reporting that widespread sexual harassment causes them stress today than said the same in 2018, 45% in 2019 versus 39% in 2018. Immigration is cited as a stressor by nearly half of adults, with Hispanic adults most likely identified as a stressor, with two-thirds. Discrimination is another stressor that has become more prevalent in recent years, 25% versus 20% in 2015. In 2019, the majority of people of color, 63%, say that discrimination has hindered them from having a full and productive life, with a similar proportion of LGBTQ adults, 64%, expressing the same sentiment. When looking at the responses of people of color, this year's results represent a significant increase from 2015. The last time this set of questions was asked, with less than half, 49%, said that discrimination prevented them from having a full and productive life. The average reported stress level remains constant, and compared with last year, 4.9 in 2019 and 4.9 in 2018 on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is little or no stress and 10 is a great deal of stress. So it looks like our overall levels of stress are holding steady, but we're definitely seeing changes in the overall landscape. Okay, next up from the Washington Post. Hospital alarms prove a noisy misery for patients. I feel like I'm in jail. Tens of thousands of alarms shriek, beep, and buzz every day in every U.S. hospital. All sound urgent, but few require immediate attention or get it. Intended to keep patients safe by alerting nurses to potential problems, they also create a riot of disturbances for patients trying to heal and get some rest. Nearly every machine in a hospital is now outfitted with an alarm. Infusion pumps, ventilators, bedside monitors tracking blood pressure, heart activity, and a drop in oxygen in the blood. Even beds are alarmed to detect movement that might portend a fall. The glut of noise means that the medical staff is less likely to respond. Alarms have ranked as one of the top 10 health technological hazards every year since 2007, according to the research firm ECRI Institute. This could mean staffs were too swamped with alarms to notice a patient in distress, or that the alarms were misconfigured. The Joint Commission, which accredits hospitals, warned the nation about the frequent and persistent problem of alarm safety in 2013. It now requires hospitals to create formal processes to tackle alarm safety issues. But there is no national data on whether progress has been made in reducing the prevalence of false and unnecessary alarms. The commission has estimated that of the thousands of alarms going off throughout a hospital every day, an estimated 85 to 99% do not require clinical intervention. Staff facing widespread alarm fatigue can miss critical alerts, leading to patient deaths. Patients may get anxious about fluctuations in heart rate or blood pressure that are perfectly normal. In bed alarms, a recent arrival can lead to immobility and dangerous loss of muscle mass when patients are terrified that any movement will set off the bleeps. In the past 30 years, the number of medical devices that generate alarms has risen from about 10 to nearly 40, said Priyanka Shah, a senior project engineer at ECRI Institute. A breathing ventilator alone can emit 30 to 40 different noises, she said. In addition to triggering bed alarms, patients who move in bed may set off false alarms from pulse oximeters, which measure the oxygen in a patient's blood, or carbon dioxide monitors, which measure the level of the gas in someone's breath. Maria Savek, an alarm expert and director of policy management and integration for Johns Hopkins Health System, found that one step-down unit, a level below intensive care in the hospital, an average of 350 alarms went off per patient per day from the cardiac monitor alone. She said no international standard exists for what these alarms sound like, so they vary by manufacturer and device. It's really impossible for the staff to identify by sound everything they hear, she said. The flood of alarms creates a cry-wolf phenomenon, she said. The alarms are constantly calling for help. The staff look at them. They say that's just a false alarm, and they ignore the real alarm. Bed alarms, for example, are meant to summon nurses so they can supervise patients to walk safely. But research has shown that the use of alarms doesn't prevent falls. Nursing staffs are often stretched thin and don't reach the bedside before a patient hits the ground. Meanwhile, patients may feel immobilized at a time when even a few hundred steps per day could significantly improve their recovery. Immobility in the hospital can create other problems for patients, leaving them with often irreversible functional decline, research has shown. They're loud. For some patients, it's frightening. They don't know where it's coming from. It's a source of irritation, she said. For some patients, they won't move. Meanwhile, some hospitals are trying to quiet the noise. By customizing alarm settings and converting some audible alerts to visual displays at nurses' stations, Savak's team at Johns Hopkins reduced the average number of alarms from each patient's cardiac monitor from 350 to about 40 per day, she said. But that's just one device in one unit. Other devices and types of care require different customized settings. Wow. Well, that all lends to support. One of my favorite sayings is that hospital is no place for a sick person. Okay, moving on to ProPublica.org. The $11 million Medicare tool that gives seniors the wrong insurance information. The federal government recently redesigned a digital tool that helps seniors navigate complicated Medicare choices, but consumer advocates say it's malfunctioning with alarming frequency, offering inaccurate cost estimates and creating chaos in some states during the open enrollment period. In Nebraska, miscalculations offered through the new Medicare Plan Finder were so worrisome that the state in late October temporarily shut down a network of about 350 volunteer Medicare advisors for a day because without the tool narrowing the numerous choices, more than 4,000 Medicare plans available nationwide down to top three selections would be nearly impossible. Days later, Envision RX Plus, a prescription drug plan, sent an email to independent insurance brokers nationwide recommending they not use the Medicare plan finder because of incorrect estimates on drug prices and patient deductibles. Minnesota's Association of Area Agencies on Aging said in a news release on November 14th that the Medicare plan finder continues to produce flawed results, including inaccurate premium estimates, incorrect prescription drug costs, and inaccurate costs with extra help subsidies. More than 60 million people use Medicare, which covers those over 65 and the disabled. Users have to pick their plans annually. The current open enrollment period ends December 7th. Medicare advisors, as well as advocates for seniors, worry that the full weight of the tool's inaccuracies will not be felt until the 2020 coverage year begins and seniors head to pharmacies to fill prescriptions or show up for medical appointments. For many Medicare participants, selections made during open enrollment are irreversible. Millions of people are going to be absolutely affected, said Ann Kayrush, Senior Program Manager for Medicare at the National Council on Aging. And you hate to think about millions of people having the wrong plan. That's kind of crazy. It's not like there's one consistent problem that you can fix that can be addressed, said David Lipschultz, Associate Director of the Center for Medicare Advocacy. It's really like a game of whack-a-mole. Millions of Medicare beneficiaries use the plan finder to reevaluate their insurance choices during open enrollment. The tool drives traffic to Medicare.gov, where users may filter, sort, and compare choices. A recent Kaiser Family Foundation analysis found that beneficiaries will have an average of 28 Medicare Advantage plans and 28 prescription drug plans to choose from in 2020. There was no alert on the federal website warning of possible inaccuracies because of the redesign. Choosing from myriad options can be so befuddling to the typical Medicare participant that states offer help through the federally supported Senior Health Insurance Program, which offers free one-on-one counseling to those eligible for Medicare, their families, and caregivers. You put in the drugs and you put in the pharmacies they want to go, and it prices them out, said Alicia Jones, administrator of the Senior Health Insurance Information Program in the Nebraska Department of Insurance. Without the plan finder, she said, the only way to do that is go to 29 different websites and do them individually. Okay, folks, an important thing to understand about this confusion is that these 28 different programs on average per state is related to the Medicare Advantage plans, which is the privatized version of Medicare. The many permutations of these plans is another example of the wonders of the free market in a complex product and set of services like healthcare. It really doesn't work well. If we had simple, good coverage for everyone, this would not be a problem. Okay, in a somewhat related story, this from the Clarion Ledger, about how Medicaid expansion not being used, not using one standard for the entire nation, leads to problems. Mississippi forfeits $1 million a day in Medicaid funds. How does it affect the mentally ill? By resisting Medicaid expansion, Mississippi is forfeiting more than $1 million a day that could help thousands of uninsured people with untreated mental illnesses and healthcare providers drowning in uncompensated costs, says State Senator Rob Hyman, Vice Chairman of the Senate Medicaid Committee. Renewed discussions about expanding Medicaid are coming at a time when a federal court ruling in September slammed the state for over-institutionalizing people with mental illnesses by failing to provide adequate community-based services. Robert Roberson, General Counsel and Vice President for Policy and State Advocacy for the Mississippi Hospital Association, presented a proposal for Medicaid expansion that he said would cost the state nothing and result in a healthier, more productive workforce. Mental Health America's 2020 annual report shows that there are 77,000 uninsured Mississippians with a diagnosable mental, behavioral, or emotional disorder. Because many uninsured people with mental illnesses do not receive treatment, their conditions worsen and they risk becoming disabled, said Debbie Plotnick, Mental Health America's Vice President for Mental Health and Systems Advocacy. They also have repeated cycles of crisis and they show up in the emergency room or worse yet, the criminal justice system. When we think about diversion, we only think about diverting people with mental illness from jail. What we need to do is divert them from disability, and the way to do that is to give them treatment and services before they become disabled. Healthcare providers who derive substantial revenues from Medicaid say expansion would also alleviate the financial hemorrhaging of Mississippi's regional community mental health centers and hospitals that are saddled with the burgeoning cost of caring for uninsured individuals unable to pay their bills. We have had hospitals that have discontinued providing inpatient psychiatric services because a lot of their patients were uninsured adults for whom they received no payments. Hospitals across the state absorbed $660 million in uncompensated care costs in 2018. Five of Mississippi's rural hospitals have closed partially because of uncompensated care, and four of them have filed for bankruptcy. Roberson has spent the past several years traveling the state to garner support for the Hospital Association's plan to expand Medicaid through a special waiver that would not cost the state a dime. While the federal government would have to approve the waiver, the state legislator must first give its okay. Roberson said the plan is a good health care policy that addresses the concerns of both Republicans and Democrats. Medicaid expansion, a major component of the Affordable Care Act, allows states to broaden their Medicaid eligibility requirements to provide health insurance to non-disabled adults shut out of the federal-state program because they are not poor enough or sick enough, Plotnick said. While Medicaid expansion is a highly partisan issue, some red states, like Indiana under then-Governor Mike Pence, have adopted it through a waiver that gives states more flexibility of how to design their program, such as work requirement. Roberson said the Association's plan is modeled after the Pence program in Indiana. Contrary to misconceptions, most Medicaid recipients work, and most of the individuals who would benefit from Medicaid expansion are working adults with low incomes, one-third of whom are struggling with mental health conditions. Most of these individuals are working in low-income jobs, but their employers do not offer health benefits, and they cannot afford to purchase insurance, so they are left without any options for insurance. Medicaid allows people unable to work because of their medical condition to attend to their medical needs so they can gain employment and keep their jobs. Medicaid beneficiaries do not receive any money. Data from the Kaiser Family Foundation shows the majority of Medicaid enrollees in Mississippi, 55%, are working adults with low incomes, and 68% of Medicaid expenditures go toward caring for the elderly and people with disabilities. Mississippi is one of 14 states that have not expanded Medicaid. Brian calls the state's failure to expand Medicaid one of the most illogical public policy decisions that I've ever heard of. It's more important for the politicians to denounce Obamacare than it is to try to figure out what to do to help people. Okay, and rolling with another related story. The common theme being mental health. Mental health studies lump transgender teens under one umbrella and miss clues to help them in the process. This from Stat News. The disparities are staggering. A growing body of research suggests that transgender teens experience suicidal thoughts and attempt to take their own lives far more often than their cisgender peers. But in many studies and surveys on adolescent mental health, transgender teens are lumped together in one big group. A transgender teen boy is treated the same, in terms of the research, as a non-binary teen who was assigned male sex at birth or as a transgender girl. Many other studies and surveys don't ask about gender identity at all. A handful of researchers are pushing to change that by making research more detailed when it comes to gender identity, and they are armed with evidence suggests that doing so is critical to unraveling health disparities. Transgender adolescents have been treated as this homogeneous, monolithic group, said Dr. Brian Toma, a University of Pittsburgh psychiatrist who has studied mental health among transgender teens. His research suggests it's critical to start studying the intersection of gender identity and mental health with more nuance. Gender identity is our internal, personal sense of what gender is. Everyone has a gender identity. Cisgender is a person who identifies with the same sex that they were assigned at birth. Transgender, or trans, is an umbrella term used to describe people whose true gender identity does not match the sex or gender they were assigned at birth. Many identities fall under the transgender umbrella. However, not all genderqueer or non-binary people identify as transgender, and some people who have transitioned to their true gender choose to identify as just a man or a woman instead of transgender. The binary system is something made up of two opposing parts. Gender, man, woman, and sex, male, female, are examples of binary systems. Non-binary is anything that falls outside of the binary system. Intersex, gender, queer, and bisexuality are all examples of non-binary identities. In a published paper last month in Pediatrics, Toma and his colleagues analyzed mental health among 2,000 teens, more than half of whom were transgender. They asked teens to answer two key questions. What is your current gender identity, and what gender were you assigned at birth? That two-step question revealed disparities lurking beneath the umbrella definition of transgender used in health research. Transgender boys were at the highest risk of a suicide attempt requiring medical attention, followed by non-binary teens assigned male at birth. Transgender girls were 6 times more likely than cis boys to have suicidal thoughts. But little research has been done on the disparities within these subgroups, in part because many studies rely on large national data sets like the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, a biannual anonymous questionnaire from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention used to keep tabs on a slew of health measures among adolescents. The 2019 questionnaire asked 5 questions about suicide, but only asked teenagers whether their sex is female or male. The National Survey on Drug Use and Health, another sweeping survey that collects data on young people and mental health, only asks whether a participant is male or female. That's a massive missed opportunity, experts say. Thomas said it's critical for data sets like the Youth Risk Behavior Survey to start asking more comprehensive questions. I'm hoping that work like ours will help start that conversation, he said. The wheels are in motion, but we have a long way to go. There are encouraging signs of a shift towards that practice. Toma and other experts pointed to a 2018 paper that examined suicide attempts among teens in 6 different gender identity groups. The study tapped into survey data from more than 120,000 adolescents and found transgender boys were at the highest risk of suicide attempts. More than half reported having attempted suicide, as well as more than 40% of non-binary teens and 30% of transgender girls. Wow. This field is fairly new to looking at this, said Amy Green, director of research at the Trevor Project, a nonprofit focused on suicide prevention and sexual and gender minority youth. Green and her colleagues have also have a similar paper to Tome's currently under review. The next question becomes why these disparities exist, and that's a question we really don't have answers to, said Green. She and other experts agree there's an urgent need for more research into the factors that might be behind those disparities, including victimization, access to gender-affirming care, and the use of mental health services. Wow, I just want to repeat that. When they looked at 120,000 adolescents and found transgender boys were at the highest risk of suicide attempts, more than half reporting having attempted suicide. That is astonishing something we need to be, pay more attention and do something about. Okay, and another study of understudied folks, this from the Washington Post, shooting victims have increased risk of mental harm long after physical injuries have healed, study finds. Years after being shot, a large proportion of gun victims continue to suffer from increased unemployment, alcohol and drug abuse, and post-traumatic stress disorder, a new study shows, and the effects persist even when the injuries were minor. The author points out that treatment for gun injuries may need to change. Currently, patients may be discharged quickly from the hospital, often with no checks on their mental health or follow-up care. And they say growing evidence suggests that gunshot trauma is harder to recover from than other types of injuries. When it comes to guns, we as a society and as researchers pay a lot of attention to deaths. That's what the public outrage is often focused on. But what's not captured are the people who survive, said Michael Vela, lead author on the study who began the research as a fellow at the University of Pennsylvania and is now a trauma surgeon at University of Rochester. What we found is these patients are facing long-term physical and mental health problems that just don't go away over time. Almost 40,000 people in the United States were shot to death in 2017, more than any year since at least 1968 when federal agencies began counting. As horrifying as that number is, the number who were shot by guns and survived was even greater, as many as three times more people by some estimates. One of the most alarming findings came from screening the patients for post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Even years later, almost half of the patients screened positive for probable PTSD, and among those who had been discharged from the hospital for seemingly minor injuries, 33% still screened positive for PTSD. These are patients we are routinely discharging from the emergency room and sending out into the world, often with no follow-up or assessment of the long-term mental injuries they may be facing in the months to follow, Vela said. Okay, well, I'd like to end the show on some good news. This from Science Daily. Feeling loved in everyday life linked with improved well-being. Poets and songwriters may tend to focus their artistry on passion and romance, but it may be those unsung, brief feelings of love throughout the day that are connected with psychological well-being, according to a team of researchers led by two Penn State Institute for Computational and Data Sciences researchers. They added that the findings could one day lead to interventions aimed at boosting well-being. In two studies, the researchers found that people who experience higher felt love, brief experiences of love and connection in everyday life, also had significantly higher levels of psychological well-being, which includes feelings of purpose and optimism, compared to those who had lower felt love scores. They also found that people with higher felt love tended to have higher extroversion personality scores, while people with lower felt love scores were more likely to show signs of neuroticism. We took a very broad approach when we looked at love, said Zita Orovech, assistant professor of human development and family studies. Everyday felt love is conceptually much broader than romantic love. It sees micro moments in your life when you experience resonance with someone. For example, if you're talking to a neighbor and they express concern for your well-being, then you might resonate with that and experience it as a feeling of love, and that might improve your well-being. According to the researchers, the baseline of the subject's felt love experiences in general rose throughout the study, suggesting that the nudges to recognize examples of love and connection during the study may also have gradually increased the subject's overall sense of being loved. Stronger experiences of felt love, in turn, are associated with improvements in psychological well-being. It's something that we've seen in the literature on mindfulness. When people are reminded to focus attention on positive things, their overall awareness of these positive things begins to rise. Similarly, just by paying attention to those everyday moments of felt love, we may also increase our awareness of the overall positive aspects of love in our daily lives. This effect replicates in both studies, implying that raising awareness of felt love in day-to-day life may itself be an intervention that raises levels of felt love over a longer period of time. So, as we end the show, my wish for you is that you feel much love this day and in the future. Well, that wraps it up for our show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. That's T-O-P-P-U-N. If you'd like to re-listen to this show, listen to an earlier show, or queue up future shows, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.